I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. This past November, President Obama and the Chinese president made a commitment to reduce their nation's greenhouse gas emissions. A month later, in December, diplomats representing 196 countries meeting in Lima, Peru, agreed to cut their fossil fuel emissions. These countries will meet again in Paris this year to formalize their plans. Meanwhile, the Japan Meteorological Agency announced recently that 2014 was the hottest year on record for global temperatures. Today in Radio Times, the science, the politics, and the public opinion on global warming, we have three guests. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Irina Marinov. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Pennsylvania. Her work focuses on how the oceans both respond to and influence climate change. Irina Marinov, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Joining us by telephone is Michael Mann, distinguished professor of meteorology at Penn State University, also director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center, author of a book called The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Michael Mann, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Marty.
And our third guest is Naomi Oreskes, and she's a professor of the history of science and affiliated professor of earth and planetary science at Harvard University, co-author of two books, The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future, and Merchants of Doubt. And Naomi Oreskes, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning.
Good morning. Michael Mann, if I could begin with you and even begin with this this report from the Japan Meteorological Agency, 2014, the hottest on record. Is that correct?
Yes. 2014, according to the sort of first estimate that has now been sort of produced, there are various groups in the U.S. and the U.K. and other countries that estimate the global temperature, and they do it in slightly different ways. And so the first group to report now is the Japanese Meteorological Association, and they've concluded that 2014 is indeed the warmest year on record. The other groups, NASA and NOAA, for example, will be reporting their estimates within the next week, and those two are likely to demonstrate that 2014 was either tied or warmest a year on record.
And was there a part of the world that was warmer than other parts of the world?
There were. In fact, if you just look at the U.S., for example, where we had a relatively cold winter thus far over the eastern U.S. and especially the midwestern U.S., and yet the west coast has been unusually warm. Alaska has been unusually warm. 2014 was the warmest year on record for California. It was the warmest year on record for Alaska. Second warmest on record for Oregon.
Naomi, I think that oftentimes in discussions about climate change, people confuse weather with climate. Can you speak to that?
Sure, of course. People don't experience climate so much as they experience weather. We experience a hot day, a cold day, a warm summer, a hot summer. So we respond to our personal experience, but that's not what climate change is really about. What climate change is really about is the larger pattern, that the world as a whole is getting warmer and that our whole climate system is being altered by changes in the basic physics and chemistry of our atmosphere caused by greenhouse gases. So scientists like Mike and Irina work hard to step back from our daily experience and to look at all of the available data from the globe as a whole to understand how the climate system as a whole is changing. And that's really what's at stake. It's not so much what the weather looks like on any given day, although as the climate as a whole changes, our experience of weather will change too. And I think increasingly in the last few years, people are beginning to see that. People are beginning to see the way the weather in their own communities is changing in noticeable ways, despite all the normal ups and downs, you know, that we also experience.
Irina, let me get you in on the conversation and also talk a bit about some of the research you've been doing looking at oceans. And help us understand then the connection between oceans and climate change, whether climate change, how climate change affects oceans.
Oceans are extremely, extremely important in how climate behaves, and they will be increasingly important in the future in our predicting future climate change. Importantly, of the heat trapping that humanity has, of the greenhouse effect that humanity has produced so far since the Industrial Revolution, most of this extra greenhouse heat ends up into the ocean. The latest numbers from the IPCC are 93% of the anthropogenic heat, of the heat that humanity produces, basically goes into the ocean. So the atmosphere would be much, much, much warmer, 20 degrees or so warmer, if we didn't have the oceans to do this.
Absorbing essentially
this extra heat. The oceans also account for they take up basically a quarter of the CO2, of the carbon dioxide that we put into the atmosphere. So again, they have a nice number, 4 kilograms per person per day.
This I don't is know how, what that means.
4 kilograms carbon dioxide per person per day are being taken up by the oceans. So a quarter of all the CO2 that we produce goes into the ocean. So again, they're a very, very important part of climate change. And the debate is, of course, into the future, will the oceans continue to take up as much heat as they're presently taking, will the efficiency of these uptake of heat and uptake of carbon dioxide increase or decrease? These are very important questions that are being researched in the community.
Michael Mann, let me go back to you, because oftentimes scientists say, you know, going back to the late 19th century, we see these trends trends of climate change. Your research has gone back to, what, 1,000 years?
Yeah, and other researchers as well. And so I would actually like to follow up on some related comments both made by Naomi and Arena.
Sure.
I think Naomi made a key point here that 2014, the fact that this is the warmest year on record, in isolation might not seem very meaningful, but it didn't occur in isolation. The warmest year on record occurred during the warmest decade on record. The warmest decade on record occurred during what we think was the warmest multi-decadal period in at least 1,000 years. And yes, some of our early research demonstrated that recent warmth is unprecedented over at least the last 1,000 years, but numerous other groups have reported similar results in the intervening decade and a half since our original hockey stick publication. And so that is now a robust determination by the scientific community that the rate of warming that we are seeing now is unprecedented as far back as we can extend these records, which are more than 1,000 years back in time. A point made by Irina, which was very important, the role of the ocean. You hear in sort of contrarian circles when it comes to climate change, sometimes the claim made that global warming supposedly stopped or there's a hiatus in global warming. Well, that simply isn't true, but it's based in part on the fact that there was a moderate slowdown in the warming of the surface of the ocean in recent years, as the ocean was actually burying more heat beneath the surface. And so what might have appeared as a slowdown in warming was simply an artifact of only looking at the surface and not realizing that all that heat that seemed to be missing was actually going into the heating of the ocean. And that's even more problematic because the ocean has a very long response time scale. When you warm the ocean, that warming penetrates down into the depths of the ocean over timescales of decades and even centuries, contributing to sea level rise for centuries to come. So the warming that we are now seeing of the upper ocean is guaranteeing additional sea level rise for hundreds of years. And it's sort of a sobering reminder of the commitment that we are making right now, the actions that we are engaged in now, the fossil fuels we're burning and the carbon we're adding to the atmosphere, are locking in potentially dangerous climate changes decades and centuries down the line.
Naomi, let me toss something to you, and I know Irina wants to weigh in as well, but I'm thinking about sea level rise, which is measurable, and I've often thought that, you know, if we could see, you know, CO2 emissions the way we could see the sort of smog of times past, taste it and feel it. But with sea level rise, you can measure that. What is public opinion when it comes to things like climate change? Do people believe it? Do they not believe it? Where do they stand today?
Well, this is a very complicated issue because what we know about public opinion is that, like the weather, it's fickle, and public opinion shifts a lot with very short-term fluctuations, just like the weather does. But what we really need to know about is the climate of opinion, and the polls show that actually the situation with respect to the American people is much better than most of us think, that actually the majority of the American people now, 60 or 70%, say that, yes, they do accept that the climate is changing, and the majority of us also accept that it's probably mostly caused by things that people do. Polls even show that the majority of us would be willing to, that we want government action on this, and that we would even be willing to spend some money on it, although exactly how much we don't agree about. So the reality is that the American people are not morons, and they have basically got the picture, but that picture has been complicated and confused and distorted by something that Mike just referred to, which is that we have been experiencing for more than 20 years now a systematic campaign to confuse us on the issue, to tell us that we're not really sure if there's climate, to change, to claim that maybe it's stopped, to claim that it's not really caused by people, to claim that we don't really know what it's caused by, to claim that scientists aren't really sure. And this is what I've studied in my own work. I've studied this campaign. And so this is very, very problematic because it's part of why public opinion is soft or fickle, because people, even though they get the general idea, they're also confused about almost all of the details. And because they're confused about the details, it's very easy for people to then be persuaded by someone who comes along and says, oh, the warming has stopped. And, of course, the other reason why it matters is because it matters for action. If politicians think that the American people don't care about the issue, if politicians think that the American people don't have a sense of urgency about it, then there's no incentive for politicians to act. And meanwhile, there are enormous disincentives because of the role of fossil fuel industry lobbying, because this is a hard problem and politicians don't like to take on hard problems. So we have lots of disincentives for politicians to act and only relatively modest political incentives for them to act.
And we're almost up on a break, and I do want to pick up on all of that. Rena, I know you wanted to add something. Can you toss something in quickly?
Oh, no, I was just going to to add to her point, the fact that it's important to note here that there is actually a very strong consensus among the scientists at this point in time about how real this problem is, and how the fact that the climate warming that we are perceiving now is primarily that human induced, and that we can distinguish it very strongly, this long-term climate change pattern that we are producing, from the fluctuations, which we call interannual variability, the natural fluctuations of the system, and that, I don't know the precise number, but 95 to 99% of climate scientists agree on this right now, and there is a big discrepancy between that and the general public.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll pick up on our conversation, talking with Irina Marinov, Michael Mann, and Naomi Oreskes about climate change. And calls, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we are talking about global warming, the research, the politics, and the public opinion. And again, our guests are Naomi Oreskes. She's a professor of the history of science and affiliated professor of earth and planetary sciences at Harvard University. Michael Mann, distinguished professor of meteorology at Penn State University, also director of the Penn State Earth Science Systems Center, wrote a book called The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. And here with us in our Philadelphia studio, Irina Marinov, assistant professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Pennsylvania. Her work focuses on oceans and how oceans both respond to and influence climate change. I actually want to play a very short clip. This is from James Inhofe. He's a Republican senator from Oklahoma, wrote a book called The Greatest Hoax, How the Global Warming Conspiracy Threatens Your Future. He is now the head of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, and this is the panel that makes most environmental policy in the government. And this is Senator Inhofe speaking on the U.S. Senate floor on August 2012.
The fact that all this is happening is due to man-made gases, I really believe, is the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. And as a result of that, a lot of people are trying to do things to this country that are detrimental.
I mean, Michael Mann, how do you respond to that, or how do you counter that?
Well, I did actually respond to it in a sense with my book, which came out the very same month that James Inhofe's book came out. And in my book, I talk about my experiences in the center of the climate change debate, which include participating in hostile testimony, testifying to Inhofe's committee, being subject to, again, hostile questioning from politicians like James Inhofe, who don't accept what the overwhelming majority of scientists in the world have concluded, that climate change is real, it's caused by us, and it's a problem we need to deal with. Now, yesterday, and I don't know if your listeners realize this, but more than two-thirds of the House of Representatives, or Republicans of the House of Representatives, deny that climate change is real. The majority of Republicans in the Senate deny that climate change is real. And in fact, the denial is so entrenched that Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island yesterday had to try to pass an amendment to a bill on the Keystone Pipeline, a sense of the Senate amendment that would at least get the Senate to agree that climate change is not a hoax. And I tweeted in response to that at the time that maybe he should follow that up with an amendment, a sense of the Senate amendment, that the Earth is not flat, that owls exist, and any number of other things that we don't dispute, when the scientists don't dispute, and yet we have this huge gulf. You know, as Irina, I think, mentioned, you know, anywhere between 97 to 99% of the scientific community is on record in supporting the consensus, recognizing the consensus that climate change is real, it's caused by us. And yet, when you look at public opinion, it's much lower. And when you look at opinion leaders, in particular, when you look at Congress, you find that the percent of acceptance is even lower. And that is a testament to the effectiveness of this long-fought industry-funded, fossil fuel industry-funded campaign to muddy the waters, to confuse the public about the reality of climate change. It's very much like what the tobacco industry did decades ago.
Well, to you, Naomi, you have said, in fact, sort of called out scientists, Michael Mann has done this, but called out to scientists to say it's time to speak out. It's time to explain not just the science, but perhaps even take on some of the climate deniers or certainly the climate skeptics. What do you think is holding some scientists back?
Well, I think there are a lot of things that hold scientists back. So in our book, Merchants of Doubt, we track the whole history of climate change denial and show that it actually had its roots in the tobacco industry and the strategy that the tobacco industry had first developed more than half a century ago to deny the scientific evidence related to the harms of tobacco. So on one level, this isn't really new. This is something that's been going on for a long time, but most of us haven't really been so aware of it because we haven't been aware of the connections between what happened in the tobacco industry, which seems like a completely different issue, and in many ways is a completely different issue, and the fact that these same kinds of strategies have been applied to climate change. So most scientists who I've worked with and talked with actually had no idea about any of this until quite recently, until folks like Mike and myself started writing about it and talking about it. Most scientists are just doing their science. And I think that throughout the 1990s and 2000s, many scientists thought that what they were facing was simply a question of public understanding of science. And they thought that if we scientists and academics did a better job of explaining what we knew, then people would understand it and we would move forward. I had one person, a Nobel laureate, one time ask me how he could have better explained the science to Republicans. And I had to say, well, this isn't really about that. So I think the scientific community has been a little bit slow in understanding the nature of the problem, just by virtue of the fact that most scientists are in their labs or in the field or in Greenland doing their work. Now the scientific community increasingly understands that what we're facing is not simply a question of public understanding, but it's still very, very difficult for the scientific community to know what to do about it because scientists are scientists. They want to do science. That's what they're trained to do. That's what they're paid to do. And they don't want to get involved in politics. And on some level, they probably, in a sense, shouldn't actually get involved in politics because it's not their job. But the problem is that leaves a big gap. It leaves a big gap between the scientists who understand and have proven beyond any reasonable doubt what's going on in the natural world, versus politicians who are playing a completely different game, who are defending the entrenched interests of the oil, gas, and coal industry in the United States, who are defending an entrenched status quo, and who don't want to see changes in our economic system. So in a way, it's almost like these groups are operating in parallel universes. Mike is one of the few scientists who has tried to, transcend the gap between those two universes. And if you read his book, you will see, you know, the high price that he has paid for trying to do that, and the terrible attacks and the terrible, things that he has had to put up with when he's tried to call out people who are deliberately misrepresenting what the scientific evidence tells us.
Well, let me go back to you, Irina. You're a real scientist, though, working in a real lab here in Philadelphia, doing research on oceans. And I guess part of this evidence that people need that there is indeed climate change and there are noticeable changes to the environment that we live in.
Yes. So one of the, just to come back to, we started earlier to discuss a little bit the role of the ocean in climate change.
Exactly.
I look very specifically at the oceans, and lately we have looked a lot at the Southern Ocean, which is a huge amount of ocean south of 40 degrees south surrounding Antarctica. And we are, it's very unexplored. In general, it's much harder to measure the ocean than the atmosphere. It's much easier to put balloons in the atmosphere than to put buoys in the deep ocean. So we know the atmosphere much more. And, of course, the Arctic and particularly the ocean around Antarctica, we know the least about. The deeper we go into the ocean, the less we know about the ocean. And what's important to say is that the there's been a series of papers. I have in mind the Perkey and Johnson papers of the last 5 years, for example, that show for the first time measurements of the current recent warming in the deep ocean.
The warming of the currents.
The warming of the currents that start from Antarctica and sink to the deep ocean below 2,000 meters. And for the first time, we're observing heating of the deep ocean, which we think is related to this human-produced anthropogenic heating. And we're observing the warming of the ocean waters at depth below 4,000 meters. And this is very new and is very recent.
And worrisome.
And worrisome, yes. And we're also noticing a freshening of the waters as it rains more, and more of the fresh water from glaciers melting, etc., and the Antarctic ice sheet melting. We're going to notice freshening of the waters, which changes the how much of this what we call Antarctic bottom water, how much of these deep currents are forming. And again, this has complicated implications for future climate, because these big strong currents that sink in Antarctica take with them large amounts of carbon dioxide and large amounts of heat to the deep ocean. So they have a very useful role in the system. And the question is, if this particular water mass is slowing down, what will be the implications for carbon dioxide uptake and heat uptake? This is just one example of the million things that they're changing. Physics of the oceans is changing. The biology is changing. The chemistry of the ocean is changing. Of course, we've heard a lot about, if we've heard more in the news recently about acidification of the oceans. So as we're putting CO2 into the oceans are acidifying, and this has not only biological implications for corals and for plants and animals in the ocean that have calcium carbonate shells, But it also has chemical implications. The more CO2 we put into the ocean, the less carbon dioxide the ocean can actually take.
Let me quickly reintroduce everybody. That's Irina Maranov, also with us, Michael Mann, and Naomi Oreskes. And we are talking about what we know about, or what scientists know about, global warming, some of the research, certainly some of the politics involved, and public opinion as well. And that looks like an explosion of phone calls here. I've got two screens going full of all sorts of comments. Let me get Jane from Wynwood to join us on Radio Times. Jane, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Something I've noticed is in the paper that the corporations are waking up to global warming, and they are the culprits in many ways, so I'm very glad about that. The other thing I'd like to say is my son is at the University of California in San Diego. He is working to get his degree in atmospheric biochemistry, and currently, as we speak today, he is up flying every day. He's not the pilot, but they are measuring the clouds. He took me to his lab. I visited in October. It was most interesting. And he told me about the particles that measured in the air, the waves in the ocean. All these are just ways of learning about all of this climate change. And it's just been most interesting. And they built this machine. They took
let me just jump in here only because, and I appreciate the fact of what your son is doing. And I wonder to you, Michael Mann, whether what Jane is also saying is that there is more research going on, there is more interest, there is perhaps more consensus that the world needs to do something to address this problem that seems to be already kind of baked into the system.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate the caller's comments, because science is always an ongoing process. And the reason that we love science so much is that any day you can wake up and learn something new, find out something new. And that's what sort of keeps us moving forward. And so you sometimes hear the critics say, oh, well, these scientists, they're all sort of just agreeing with this consensus because it's what keeps the grant money coming in, which is and it generates publications, which is foolish on many levels, not the least of which is that as a scientist, the way you get ahead isn't by agreeing with everyone else, saying the status quo is correct. It's by finding something new, finding a new angle, finding a flaw in conventional thinking, advancing the forefront of science. And so that's going on at every scientific institution and academic institution in this country, where there are atmospheric science researchers like here at Penn State or at Scripps or at Harvard or at Penn. That's what keeps science moving forward, and young scientists getting involved, trying to figure things out. For example, the caller mentioned that her son is studying cloud properties. One of the key uncertainties right now in climate change is the precise role of clouds, because clouds can be both a cooling effect and a warming effect. And scientists for a number of years have been trying to determine the precise balance of the different cloud influences, because it impacts, for example, projections of how much warming of the globe we're going to see. Now, some critics will tell you, there's uncertainty. They don't know the precise role of clouds. And so that's an example of why we shouldn't take action to lower carbon emissions, because they're not certain. Well, where else in our lives do we require, 100% certainty to act on a problem? And in the case of climate change, interestingly, when you talk about clouds, and this is just one example of, as we start to resolve some of the uncertainties, we find out that the science isn't weighing in our favor, it's weighing against us. The latest research suggests that clouds may have more of a warming influence than we thought, and the projections may call for even greater amounts of warming. So as we start to resolve these uncertainties, many of them are resolving themselves in the sense that the problem is potentially even worse than we thought. And Naomi has written very eloquently on this and how it is that scientists tend to be overly reticent and conservative in the way they frame their results, and in fact understate some of this recent evidence that climate change is potentially unfolding even faster and with greater magnitude than we once thought it would.
Well, let me pick up on that. And going back to you, Naomi, and I always worry when we do shows like this is that, it feels like a lot of really bad and scary news that, that our future is somehow doomed because of climate change. And oftentimes when people are afraid, they don't want to think about something. How do you or how do we address that?
Well, this is a very complicated problem because we know that if you give people too much bad news, they can just shut down. But at the same time, if we were to pretend that it's all fine and that we have lots of time left to solve this problem, we would be lying. So my most recent book, The Collapse of Western Civilization, is an attempt to reconcile that tension. So Eric Conway and I wrote a book that we think is actually kind of a fun book. It's short. It's easy to read. It isn't bogged down with a whole lot of complicated technical scientific detail. And it's written in the form of a story. It's a science fiction story about people in the future looking back at the present. But what it does is what it tries to do is communicate to people what is at stake for us if we continue to deny this problem and fail to act on it. Hmm. So, you know, both Mike and Rena have been talking about a lot of the important scientific detail. And, of course, this is one of the other problems that scientists have, is that scientists are really interested in what we don't know, because that's their job. Their job is to answer the questions that have not yet been answered. But from the point of view of public policy, what's most important is what we do know. And what we know is that we face a very grave problem, a very serious problem that threatens the health, well-being, prosperity, and economic future of our country and all the countries around the globe. And the longer we wait to act on it, the worse it gets. And so this is why the denial in Congress is so serious. Even, you know, when you really stop and think about it, if you're a person who's followed this issue closely, like Mike and I have for a long time, it's frankly terrifying. We have people in Congress who are telling us that the sky is green, who are telling us that it's all fine, who are telling us that smoking cigarettes is good for you. I mean, this is the functional equivalent of telling us that smoking cigarettes prevents cancer. That's really how bad it is on a scientific, intellectual, and political level. But it's hard to say that in public because most people don't want to believe it's that bad. Most people want to think, oh, Mike and I are overreacting. But the reality is that what we've seen over the last 20 years is that we've actually underreacted, that the communications the scientific community have put out on this issue have, if anything, been conservative, have been cautious. And so that's why this feels like, I think, such an important moment, because the science is so clear, it's so overwhelming. As we started at the top of the hour, 2014 is the hottest year on record, in the hottest decade, in a long-term trend that is clearly going in the direction of very substantial warming, and all of the available scientific evidence tells us it's being driven by human activities.
I got to jump in here. We're up on a break. Sorry to do this. We're up on a break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and I've been talking with Irina Marinov and Michael Mann and Naomi Oreskes about what is known about global warming, about climate change, some of the research that's been going on, clearly some of the politics involved and public opinion as well. And I do want to talk about what we can do to address what we have been talking about, because, frankly, it sometimes feels just kind of overwhelming, especially, Naomi, when you say that scientists have been sort of underestimating the seriousness of what is going on. Interestingly, in November, President Obama, the Chinese president, met and made a commitment to reduce their nation's greenhouse gas emissions. Other countries are doing the same. And I just want to, perhaps I'll start with you, Irina, which is just to talk a little bit about some of the, I don't know if it's good news, but certainly positive news, people moving in the right direction on this issue.
Yeah, I mean, this U.S.-China joint announcement is exciting. It basically, the new U.S. goal is to double the pace of carbon pollution reduction from currently 1.2% per year during 2005-2020 to they say, 2.3 to 2.8% per year on average between 2020 and 2025. At the same time, right, China is announcing targets to peak CO2 emissions around 2030. Well, it would be nice if it were earlier than that, but it feels a ways away, meaning that they were going to ramp up perhaps before 2030, right? The more we wait, the higher the CO2 levels will be. But the idea is to they need to increase the non-fossil fuel share of all energy by 2030. And China, of course, has a huge amount of CO2 carbon dioxide production from coal. It's important to remind people here that China overtook the U.S. in in 2006 as the primary carbon dioxide producer in the world. So we've been waiting for a long time for China. We hope India will follow to do something and to say something about this. And the hope is that with the upcoming Paris meeting, the developing countries will for the first time commit strongly to emission cuts the way the European Union has done.
Michael Mann, let me go to you. And I'm wondering, someone listening to this conversation, what though can an individual do?
Right. Well, that's a great question. And there are many things that individuals can do. Probably most important is voting and making sure that we hold our elected officials accountable to represent our interests. As Naomi explained, there has been this long-fought campaign by fossil fuel interests, literally hundreds of millions of dollars spent on lobbying and pressuring politicians to not act on this problem, to act in a way that is not in the best interests of the people. And the only way we're going to stop that is by electing policymakers who will reflect and represent our interests, not the interests of the special interests who fund their campaigns. And so there are many ways to be involved in that process. Obviously, voting is one of them, but raising awareness among your friends, your family, your church, your school, making sure that your friends and your family and your coworkers are all aware of how concerned you are about this problem, which is not just a problem for polar bears in the Arctic, although it's sometimes portrayed that way. It is hurting us now here in Pennsylvania. Anywhere you go, anywhere I go and I lecture about climate change, I can point to specific stories about that region and how it is suffering already from the impacts of climate change. But the real tragedy here is that there is this procrastination penalty, as Arena alluded to. The decisions we're making right now have a legacy of centuries of climate change that they may lock in. And if we are going to preserve this planet for our children and grandchildren, preserve the planet anything like what it was when we grew up, we are going to need to bring down our carbon emissions dramatically. So people need to do everything they can to raise public awareness, write letters to the local newspaper, give talks and lectures about this if they have the capacity to do that, and just make sure that the people around them are aware of this problem and the threat that it really poses to us, to our children, to our grandchildren. But then finally, there are, of course, lots of things that we can do on a voluntary basis to decrease our own personal carbon footprints, reducing our energy usage, recycling, using public transportation or bicycling to work when we can. There are so many things that we can do in our personal lives that would make a pretty big dent in our collective carbon footprint if we all acted this way. But ultimately, the only way we're really going to solve this problem is through policies that put a price on the emission of carbon. Every molecule of CO2 that's put into the atmosphere is doing damage to the planet. It's doing damage to us, our economy, our national security, our food and water safety. Ultimately, we need to internalize that damage. We need to put a price on the emission of carbon so that we level the playing field in the energy industry and renewable energy, non-carbon energy, can compete fairly in the marketplace. That's what we're going to need if we're really going to stabilize warming below dangerous levels.
Naomi, I have an email from Fred. He asks, is the global warming at the point where it is now unstoppable for the next few decades, even if we reduce our use of fossil fuels?
Well, the answer to that is yes and no. Some degree of warming is inevitable now. And I think Irina spoke before about the commitment. When scientists talk about the commitment, that's what they're talking about. They're saying that there's a lock-in right now. I don't like to use the word commitment because, as my teenager daughter likes to say, only men think commitment is a bad thing.
But, we're not going to go down that path, but yes.
Yeah, but we are locked into a certain degree of warming. But the key point is that the worst impacts can still be avoided if we act now. But the emphasis is on the now. And Mike referred to some of the technological changes that can help us fix this problem. And as a historian, I'm very interested in that because we know quite a bit about the history of technology. And one of the things we know is that 20 to 30 years is quite a bit of time to make technological change. And we also know that we really need to get our emissions down by the year 2050. That's a number that many people cite. So if we begin to act now, we still have the capacity to implement the green technologies, the low-carbon technologies that will enable us to prevent dramatic future warming. But we have to do it now. The longer we wait, the harder it gets. And if we wait much longer, then we sort of lose this window of opportunity for technological change.
Let me get Tim from Allentown to join our conversation. Hi, Tim. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, great. Thank you so much.
You're
so
welcome.
I wanted to say that it was my job at one point. I went to school for political science, and I worked for a public interest research group on this issue specifically. And that was years ago now because I had to give it up. It was a little stressful, considering some of the anxiety that your guest talks about in her book. I'm definitely going to buy that and read it and recommend it to my friends. But it is very scary that our leadership, that our elected policy makers are doing this to us. I'm appalled. That's my comment. My question is, what could, as somebody who's been down that path, whose job it was to inform the public on this issue and to have people do letter writing campaigns and to do lobbying in the state of which I was a part, a citizen.
What is your question?
My question is I know that I'm not representing just myself here. That a lot of us who are, especially younger folks, who are disillusioned with the process as a whole.
Yeah, Tim, we just need to know your question. No, I appreciate your passions. No, that's okay.
What can we do once we've been down that road? And for those of us like myself who are so very disillusioned and discouraged and just really kind of depressed about the situation.
Okay.
Where can we go?
Well, and this is, I see this as sort of a trend about what people can do. Should people, Irina, should our listeners be depressed? As Tim says, he and his friends are.
Well, I teach at University of Pennsylvania, and I teach climate change, and I'm very positive when I see my students in my class. They're young and they're enthusiastic, and they're much more aware of these issues than I was when I was 15 years ago in their position, and that I think we are talking about these things more and more in universities, and we are making a big effort to educate more and more young people. So I think they are my hope.
And so I don't think lose hope.
Don't lose hope. The other I saw. Just to make things a little bit lighter, I saw a fun paper the other day from scientists at Berkeley where they talk about seeing statistically significant overlap between life changes that make you happier and life changes that lower your energy use and your gas and electricity bills, which makes sense, but now they've proven it scientifically. So basically, if you want to do something for climate change, they argue, you should do fun and personally enriching activities such as sleeping, getting exercise, socializing, volunteering, getting more exercise,
so
hobbies.
You help the climate and you keep yourself
exactly
happy. So, Tim,
can I just jump in here?
Of course.
About not feeling disempowered.
Yes.
I think the situation in Washington, D.C., as we all know, is pretty depressing, but there's a lot of good things going on state level.
Yeah.
So, in Massachusetts, where I live, we have a program called Solarize Massachusetts, where homeowners can get support from the state to put solar panels on our roofs. And I did that this year. I'm now completely solar electricity in my home. And it saves you money. It makes you feel better. And it also provides a model to your friends and neighbors to show that there are things we can do that make a difference. So that's just one example. And virtually every state in the United States has something like that that people can get involved with.
And on a bigger level, perhaps the cap and trade, we should applaud the cap and trade of Washington State and many measures that California, of course, has put in place, and probably that's the way to go for the U.S.
And
if we cannot pass it at the government level, we should pass it at a state
at
level
a state
and
level.
push for cap and trade and pricing carbon at the local level.
Let me get Tom from looks like Bluebell to join our conversation. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I guess I'd like to represent the skeptic side for a couple minutes. First of all, I think a lot of people are just ignoring the political reality that the rest of the world is trying to dig themselves out of like a pre-industrial you're talking about the rest of the world's living like it's the 1850s or the 1750s. They're never going to be able to afford to do the things you're talking about we might be able to afford in the United States. So the reality is, even if we cut back to zero tomorrow, the rest of the world's got every intention of burning coal and burning oil until they can feed their people and live in a decent standard of living. So I think, you know, you can't just look at it like this is a United States problem. It's global. If it is warming, it's global. But I wanted to touch on one of the
things. Well, you know what, Tom, let me take that point only because Irina's saying no, 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 and I do want to give Michael Mann a chance to respond as well. Go ahead, Irina.
Yeah, just there's a new study that just came out in PNAS and some other studies out there that actually disagree with your finding in that the main point here is that our cities are so locked in to car dependency, for example, and commuting, that it's actually very, very hard for us, for developed countries such as the U.S., to reduce our carbon footprint, for example. While if we apply changes to urban centers in developing world, such as India and China, that they're just developing now, right, so that they improve their energy efficiency and, you know, they build subways and trains in their system before they're locked in, such as we are, into car dependency. These papers are showing that it's actually much easier for those countries to actually decrease their carbon footprint. So the hope is that through political pressure, we can make developing cities. We can convince developing cities in developing countries to change, and that's where the political pressure should be. So it's actually, if they want to, it's much easier for them to make the change than for us.
Michael Mann, let me toss something to you. I actually read in the New York Times today, I'll just quote here, in President Obama's latest move using executive authority to tackle climate change, administration officials will announce plans this week to impose new regulations on oil and gas industries' emissions of methane, a powerful greenhouse gas. Do you see that as a positive development?
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, you know, we talk a lot about CO2, and ultimately it is the carbon dioxide that we're putting into the atmosphere that has this long legacy, this long tail that'll warm the planet for centuries to millennia. And so ultimately the first order of business is bringing down CO2 emissions. And, of course, Obama administration has done everything within their power from the standpoint of executive action to do something about our CO2 emissions, both with respect to improved automobile efficiency standards and, of course, these new rules on carbon emissions from coal-fired power plants. But methane is also a potent greenhouse gas. It has a much shorter lifetime. So, again, if you're talking about the long term, and to use the word that Naomi understandably doesn't like, commitment, but the long term climate change that we are locking in, CO2 is the principal problem, and we have to go after that most intensely. Now, methane is also contributing to the warming, and over a time frame of 10 to 20 years, methane can actually be even more potent than CO2 as a greenhouse gas, as a warming agent. And so if we're talking about lowering the warming and the associated climate changes over the next few decades, then getting our methane emissions under control is going to be an important part of that. And so it's not either or. We have to be doing both. It's great to see the administration is doing that. I would also comment that with respect to this issue that was raised by the caller, a legitimate issue, people ask, well, you know, how are we going to solve this problem, here in the U.S. when the rest of the world is escalating their carbon emissions? And I would point to the caller that, you know, look, China just engaged in a very important agreement along with the U.S. to cut their carbon emissions. The largest emitter of carbon on the planet, China, with the fastest growing economy, has made a commitment to lower their carbon emissions. And if they can do it, the rest of the world can do it too.
And we do have to end on that note. We could go on. Michael Mann, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Naomi Oreskes, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And Irina Marinov, thank you for coming into our studio today. You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. Looks like we already have a pretty vigorous conversation taking place on our Facebook or certainly email as well. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.